Alrighty.
I signed it already. You could sign it, pass it over to John. All right, we have a number of members here, of course, and the president of the college is here. And Don, give us your words of wisdom. We'll take you right off the bat.
Thank you. I wanted to report out that we're 11th and a half hour formal agent on budget for next year. Some of the things we know is that our high school graduation population is slowly going down. We know who's registered in kindergarten and who's graduating this June. And over the next 12 years, it's going to be anywhere, depending on which numbers you look at, between 15 and 20% decline in high school graduation. We project our enrollments with that principal cohort, how many students are getting directly out of the high school. And then our Vice President Dean for Enrollment Management has a very complicated formula based on previous histories and semesters on how many returning students we'll have as a percentage of that cohort coming out of high school, how many students coming back from other campuses, coming to SUNY Ulster. There are a variety of cohorts that fill up the total student body. We also have a very active in high school program, as you know, called the collegiate program, where kids who are doing well can take college courses while they're in high school. And all of that gets together for an enrollment projection, and we're projecting a 5% decrease in enrollment next year. That's equating to about 100 FTEs. We will see a budget that is going to be less than what we gave to the legislature last year. I know we had some problems last year where the budget was given to you the night you were asked to approve it. Our plan is to have our Board of Trustees approve the budget next Tuesday. We had a Finance Committee meeting this morning with some of the members of the board. I think they will be prepared to approve it next Tuesday, and we'll get copies to the legislature right after that. So you'll have a few weeks between now and when we have the public hearing.
So what happens in the budget? Can you give me a synopsis real quick?
What everyone is talking about, and I would hope that this stays confidential, because we have not announced this with our people on the campus, but
during the recording.
Yeah, so we probably shouldn't.
It'll be in Natasha's possession, so I know.
Okay. But these get posted online. They get posted online normally by tomorrow morning, so rather than say anything, if you, it's better, I don't want to, I think the people there have the right to know before.
Personal decisions coupled with coming in with a balanced budget, and we haven't had to do that for a number of years. But we have pledge from the county executive, as you know, put in an additional $120,000 in our allocation for this year's county budget, and we're deeply appreciative of that. But the understanding was that was to be able to balance your budget without a tuition increase for 2 years in a row. That's what we have done. That's what the board's marching orders to us for as well. Count on additional $120,000. But don't consider any tuition increase. And the budget that you will be presenting with next week does not have a tuition increase. There have been some other changes in terms of programs that reduce revenue as well as reduce the level of spending. One is in our continuing ed area, where we were working with some communications workers and even outside of Ulster County. And we feel that that program really would be better conducted directly with Horizon rather than just being put between. And that'll be a swing of over $200,000 in the budget. Mark has been leading this review of the budget for the last 3.5 months, and I'm pleased with what we're going to be able to present to you.
And the business center out at the old Pier 1, that everything's going all right with that?
And we met with Mike Hine yesterday and the some members of the county attorney's office. I think we're finally ready to sign a bring the resolution to the full legislature to approve the signing of the lease. We did add at the last minute on the advice of the county attorney. I should have the town card with 90 days notice. They were a little squeamish about us signing a 15-year lease with a 5-year renewable option without any getting out of the contract towards it. And that will be added, and I think that took care of Mike's concerns yesterday.
As he right.
was a little worried about a 15-year commitment, as he kept saying, you know, we wouldn't know 5 years before this, but the situation would be enough. And, we wouldn't know how hard it was to balance our budget 5 years ago.
Now, is that resolution here, or do we...
It's
going to be for June, okay.
For June.
Yeah, because we spoke a couple of weeks ago, and I thought it was going... When I met with you guys a couple of weeks ago, you visited the Resource Center.
The county executive's office, and we had some concerns.
All right, so the June's not going to be a problem? June won't be a problem for you?
No.
Okay. Anybody have any questions for Mark or Don?
Do you have a resolution for the
I do have a question. What are you projecting the impact of open and salted bin will be on your enrollment?
We hope it's going to go up.
I would think so.
We have a lot of opportunity there. We're in a different part of town. Mike's vision from the very beginning when he came up with the STRIVE program was the first thing he was thinking of is how do we attract kids who dropped out of the system, who can't get on a bus and go out to Stonebridge, and then tend to be in that part of town. Either they use the city bus or they walk. I think we're going to see our numbers actually go up. We're very excited about the location and relationship to the high school, and we've had some very productive meetings with the school officials, superintendent, principal, and his associate superintendents, doing things like during ninth period, where we have kids now taking college courses in the collegiate program, but we envision them coming over to Sylvan Finn, taking 200-level courses, and for the really talented kids, it's possible that they'll get an associate degree at a college and a high school diploma at the same time, with some maybe some block scheduling and identification of a cohort that of students who could benefit from some program like that. We also have the GED program, and we feel that's going to be popular. And we also are, I don't know if the meeting is taking place yet with our dean of continuing ed, but we're very interested in in-service courses for the hospital employees. And, right across the street is going to be right for that. So
how do those numbers figure in your numbers that you just gave us?
Well, it's all about that.
Absolutely. So in other words, even when that mission's there, there's a more serious...
Right. Well, it's going to help as our traditional population continues to slip down a little bit. That if we get a robust program at Sophie Finn, I think, it'll help us balance that.
We family runs a program at Kingston High School called the Student Success Center. What it is a program came out of the city, so many high schools in the city. And we taught peers, young people, to help their fellow students apply for college, apply for financial aid. We've also addressed the ninth grade academy. We're doing tutoring. And so I would like to know somebody that my person could meet with so we could steer people to
them. Yeah, that would be great.
Let me know who to
call. I'll put to our director of admissions as soon as we get the right connection. Because
fantastic.
We actually have a similar course. It's called College Success. And we've been talking about the need to offer that at Sophie Finn. I didn't know what you were doing, and that's great to know. Maybe we don't have to reinvent the wheel here.
No, it is a bad thing. It's
worth it. That's super. You want to explain the Calder resolution?
If I could. It's here. Indicated to you guys on a couple of occasions that we struggled a little bit getting the current contract that we had for the interior renovation,
right.
The financial system. We finally figured all that stuff out. It took a little longer than we had hoped for. But in the final analysis, which happened for you, amended cost of the project, which had increased. But it does include some contingency in case we come across some more things that were well hidden within the confines of the walls and things like that, but I think this will give us a project that is we're truly happy with and excited to have for the college. And again, it's at no out-of-pocket expense for the county. This is all done to be done with the proceeds from the sale of the president's residence and the cooperation of the city construction fund.
And also the inclusion being covered by the NYSERDA grant that we're getting to the new part of that building should be used as the kitchen and bathrooms and the actual back porch that were paid by NYSERDA funds. So I think it's been a great collaboration with from a variety of resources, and we do appreciate the SUNY Construction Fund coming in to help us after we realized it was going to cost a bit more than we had originally projected. But again, Oak County funds are being asked. The reason you have to approve it is that it had to be considered a capital project
right.
for us to be able to access the SUNY Construction Fund dollars.
Right.
And we're trying to have you approve it as a capital project and then let the college hire subcontractors to do the roof, the windows, the flooring, and the county attorney's office wouldn't let us do that. They said it had to be done like all capital projects. So we are going through the Commission of Finance.
Is that
going
to end up costing more money now, I know?
We were told that it was going to cost more money because of a bond issue with the contractor, but it wasn't as much as we anticipated. It just made it a little bit more expensive and a little bit more cumbersome, but if we get this approved, we do have a little bidder.
Well, let me ask you, Claire, I don't mean to ask the tough questions here, but in other words, have you done it that way before?
We did one on the campus with renovating a science lab, which we did ourselves. We used Jeff Lyle plumbing heating to do the HVAC. We had some of our own maintenance people doing some work in it as well. And we did it out of the operating budget. We did not do it as a capital project. We obviously have to abide by the advice of the attorney if we want to use it properly or not. So.
All right, I'm just curious because some things get changed around sometimes, and I'm wondering, just wanted to figure that out. All right, on this, the amending the capital project number 405, this is resolution 208. I'd entertain a motion to accept this resolution. Move it, rather. So moved. Seconded by Jeff. Seconded by John Faraday. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. It's today the 12th
house in Albany.
Is it Albany? Dedicated to you or just part of
it? Dedicated to
not taking away from anything you had thought about down the road in Ulster for 4 years or 5 years or 2 years. Okay, thank you.
Alrighty. I'll come get him. I'm sorry.
All right, we have some resolutions that we need to run through kind of quickly, if we could. These for Ken Cornell has another engagement. Going out to dinner or something?
I've had a pretty good day.
No problem. No problem. All right, the first resolution is 206, amending the Ulster County budget to fund the Senior Meals on Wheels Plus program. Through the Office for the Aging, correct?
Yep.
Alrighty, can you fill us in? I know they need...
There's two resolutions that go together, so resolution 206 and resolution 210. There's a resolution to authorize the contract and the policy of resolution 210, the contingency fund, for additional resources in the Office for the Aging for the contract. So as you know, we had the same Meals on Wheels provider for many, many years in the county, with service that I don't think any of us was the best thing to do. And when they made the decision before Christmas that they no longer wanted to be really happy with it, we kind of took it as an opportunity. We wanted to revisit the whole program, look at it from top to bottom, and make some decisions.
Sometimes when you're forced against the wall, I guess
it's a great opportunity. And, of course, we appreciate the kind of executive says, let's use this as an opportunity, let's create a model program for the state. So we really spent a lot of time. We had a competitive bidding process in the end. The selections and each other.
How many actually bid on it?
So we four bids on a contract. They were all local bids. Actually, one was a provider for Dutchess County, but the rest were local bids. We didn't choose the lowest bid. We didn't choose the highest bid. We chose a bid that was in the middle, but also that had some really exciting programming built into it. So the contract before you right now is a total contract of $2 million. That would run through June 1st of this year to December 31st, and gives us 2 1-year renewals on the contract. Okay. The contract, there's a lot of things. It requires an additional $105,000 to finish out the balance of 2015, and it would require an additional, double that additional $210,000 for 2016. So we built that into our plan. The meal pricing is just slightly more than what we currently paid on the current contract. The delivery of the frozen meals, the price was $7.67 per meal. This raises to $7.76 price per meal. And then for the hot meal delivery, it goes from $8.91 for hot meal to $8.95 for hot meal. So, but what that does, though, is the program was designed so it has a lot more choice for the seniors. And when we were forced to go to the weekly delivery, we found that a lot of the clients of the program actually preferred to have the weekly delivery. There's a segment of the population that keeps eating the program in there. They didn't want to sit around their house every day between the set hours of 11 and 1 to get the delivery. They can schedule it once per week and then get that and have the nutrition needs met for the week. So we kept that option. We wanted to keep that option.
So when you deliver them, what do you just deliver, a frozen type meal?
Right now, every senior that's in the program is receiving a frozen meal on a weekly basis. But to be honest with you, the program is a lot more than about the meal. 600 calories per day doesn't mean you do a lot. Person. This is more about the contact and the socialization of the senior, especially the ones that are homebound. So we built, so it's really that. So what we've done is we've created a contract that has the option of the daily hot delivery or a weekly delivery for some of the more active seniors.
Now, the weekly delivery, when is that normally done?
It'll be scheduled based upon the needs of the senior.
Because I know a lot of seniors, one of the major problems they have, they may have like care. Mm-hmm. They have like somebody that comes in once a day for a couple hours, but they usually don't have them on weekends, which is kind of odd.
Yeah.
So they have Monday through Friday, and they're basically on their own Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah, again, this program isn't about providing all of the nutritional needs for.
Right. So I mean, if you were doing them. If you had a Saturday delivery, that probably might. Just to think about.
I believe that right now the schedule we're using is delivery driven release. It works out well. We serve about 350 seniors in the program right now. Over the last 11 months, we've had an average wait list of 58 seniors. So under this contract, we put in the resources to eliminate the wait list for the seniors. So we believe that it can be. Not the current need, but growth factor building. That's where we built that into the model. We didn't pay for anybody on the wait list. And then, but also, I think the most important piece of this thing is if you kind of rethought the program kind of from top to bottom. Right now, we would use just basically the volunteer help to go and deliver the meals on a daily basis. Well, we're going to retain all of the volunteers that are currently in the program and then recruit several more. But we're also providing a whole regimen of training for volunteers in. And give them a sense of what to look for. And one of the major problems we're seeing is dehydration. So people that, instead of being just a delivery person, it's going to be really a more home contact person. So they're going to go in and be able to really identify change that's happening in the house.
Aren't some of these people paid that deliver? Aren't some of the people paid that
deliver? Some of them receive mileage and some of them do not. But we built into the contract that everyone who delivers on a volunteer basis will receive 50% mileage, 50 cents per mile reimbursement. So everyone who delivers will get mileage reimbursement. But really the special piece to this, that's kind of what makes it unique, is that we built into the contract a piece where up to 95 of our seniors that are in the program that are extremely frail, that are homebound, that have no other family contact with the member, they're going to have a care coordinator from the day assigned to them who will be able to visit them up to 5 times per week and go in and actually be there for them beyond the meal delivery, if you will. Because the dollars are being paid for the training, some of the traditional barriers, and you tap into the federal Older American Act funds for meal delivery. If someone gets sick and goes into the hospital, you have to close that meal case and then reopen when they come out of the hospital. So what we've done, by supplementing it with county dollars, especially for the most frail, which is, again, up to 95 that are the most at risk, that don't have any other support, that don't have any family members, that they live in a real rural part of the county. They're going to have their own care coordinator who will be with them up to every, visiting them up to every day, depending on their need. But they'll be able to go with them to the hospital, visit them in the hospital, make sure that there's a real plan in place for them to return to their home. And address a lot of those needs. I don't think there's another county in the state that's doing this right now. I think it's going to really do a lot to keep seniors in the home, keep them independent. That's what seniors want. They want to be independent in their own home.
Right, right.
And we think it's going to deliver a lot of possible stays and also deliver a lot of nursing home placements. The senior extend their time. Something the committee should be very proud of. A lot of people in this with our director, our family member, and I spent hours and hours and hours doing this. And I think it's, again, it's going to cost us a little bit more, but we think it's going to be a good answer for the county long term. Yeah, so you should know that there's enhanced case management here, but also we can put enough resources that's going to eliminate this.
Well, I compliment you and Ken on your work. I compliment you on your work. I know you spent a lot of time on this, and I know it was sprung on the county, and all of a sudden, no, we're not going to be doing it anymore, which is, to me, is kind of unacceptable. I don't know how somebody can really just, say, oh, I don't want to do it anymore.
But the owner of that company happens to hear the tape. I'll have the director call you personally and ask him to contact him.
There you go. Very good.
But I want to give the committee some assurance. You can feel comfort that it's a very enhanced level program. Again, we haven't found another example, but also we believe we eliminated any wait list for the new program.
Very good. All right, thanks, Ken. I entertain a motion to accept Resolution 206, amending the budget for the Senior Meals on Wheels program.
Yeah.
We got Lopez and Worrell. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
All right. The follow-up resolution with that would be approving the contract in excess of $50,000, and that's through the Office for the Aging for Gateway Community Industries. I entertain a motion to accept the resolution. All right, seconded by? All right. Lopez, Worrell, all those in favor?
Aye.
One other, just a clarification, too, that I've gotten some questions from legislators understanding the clients of Gateway, how would they be involved in the programming? The clients of Gateway will officially be working in the kitchen, helping with the meal preparation and the packaging of food, and there's an opportunity for them to hire new staff. Some folks that will be looking at not only their population, but they also contract with the county through social services and some of our other temporary assistance programs. So we'll be looking to that client list to do some of these hires as well.
No. I think it's a great mix. Yeah. I like. Alrighty. The next resolution, what do we got here? All right, the Medicaid grant application would be required Medicare Improvements for Patients and Providers Act, Office of Aging. What's that about, Ken?
This is pretty standard. It's about outreach that we do. We're getting allocated. It's about $11,000. We have it in front of you. But it's something the committee's approved before.
Oh, right. It's the story they do every year.
Yeah,
I know what it is. Okay, very good.
And then 205 is everything.
The RSVP program. Well, I'll get that 207. For some reason, I jumped out of line. I said something to it. Entertain motion to approve resolution 207. Alrighty, seconded by Lopez. All those in favor? You can pass them over to John when you get done. All right, the RSVP program, go ahead.
Yeah, but as everyone on the committee knows, the college determined that the programming didn't fit their continuing mission, so they turned back the federal RSVP grants and plan on closing that program by the end of June. So, recognizing what that program is and does, we thought it important to incorporate a good portion of that programming through our Office for the Aging. So what this resolution would do would create two positions, a full-time grade six position and a part-time position at the Office for the Aging to continue. What is the bulk of the program? The program has really two major components that we're focused on right now. One is they coordinate volunteer placements. There's about 400 volunteers that volunteer through RCP right now. And they service about 39 agencies around the county. They provide staff at the hospital, at the reception desks, you name it. They're in many of our organizations. They provide help to our tourism department. They staff the caboose out on the circle during the tourism season, also provide staff down at the Heritage Center where we have our main tourism visitor center down in the roundabout. But again, so that's the main component would be to continue that recruitment. They provide a volunteer insurance. Remember, we built that into the programming. But the other major piece, the piece that we really are really getting our arms around and don't want to lose, is what they call the neighbor-to-neighbor program. This is a really important program for seniors, for very frail homebound seniors in the county, where this RSVP has always provided volunteers that provide rides to the doctors or rides to, you know, shopping or that type of thing. You know, we do have programming through the Office for the Aging when we, through UCAT, we can provide shopping or doctor visits to seniors. But there are circumstances where the volunteer driver is more appropriate for that situation. So that's another big piece of it that we're getting our arms around. It will require us to contract with a not-for-profit. We're still interviewing not-for-profits. We haven't made a return.
Well, the city of Kingston has a... one that picks up people and brings them.
Paratransit, right. Curb to curb type of a transport, whereas
right.
The volunteers will actually go and help someone out of the house, get their coat on, help them in the car. It's a little different type of a service.
Yeah, the paratransit sort of does that.
Yeah, we have the same. But
I think they're not supposed to, but they do.
Exactly, but this fills that little gap between the standard programming that we have. And again, it's used quite standard. There's about 75 people that use it on a routine basis. It's a very important programming. Because it's volunteers transporting people in their own private vehicles, it kind of created a liability problem for the county. So what we're going to do is we're going to contract with a not-for-profit. Okay, we're still interviewing several potential providers where they'll receive a small administrative fee, a couple of $1,000, not a lot. But we'll then provide them reimbursement so they can pay mileage to the volunteers and also do like DMV checks to make sure that their driver is standing with that service. So that's the bulk of what we're focused on, those two main components that will continue right away. There's a lot of other smaller programs that the RSVP does that are really nice programming. For example, they have a knitting club where they might buy yarn and they'll knit things for the volunteers. You know, I can't commit that'll continue right away. Kind of in a mode right now where we've got to get the programming in place and then we'll build on it for the 2016.
Right. I know with the college, it started costing them more and more of their own money to do it. They got to the point where they were pumping out $51,000 of their own. As a result, you know, with all their budgetary problems, they had to look back at what their core was.
The programming costs about
$100,000. So how long did you guys do it?
More than the 20 years I stated earlier.
I think it was 28.
30 years.
I think it was like 28 years or something.
Well, the
president know and all know that we appreciate that you ran that for that long, and we appreciate that you did it even though you were in the red on it. Thank you.
But again, when you're faced with something, you always look for the opportunity. So we were hopeful that as part of this programming, incorporating in the Office of Aging, we've got some other programming that's coming up. We spent a lot of time this year looking at elder abuse. We've had an elder abuse task force, of course, doing a lot of work. There'll be an elder abuse conference that will be in June, and there's some spinoff pieces of that are really important that we're looking at, where there are a lot of people that we've identified. We've just struck an agreement with IFH, the large healthcare department. They have about 3,000 seniors in their programming, and they have agreed to incorporate an elder abuse assessment into all of their senior primary care visits. And as part of that, they're going to identify seniors that are potential risk of elder abuse, and they're going to refer them to we're calling a warm mic program, Ultra Check Center is the name of it. We're going to have volunteers contacting seniors that have been referred to us on a weekly basis to check in, make sure that they're not having any issues with contractors coming to their house or any of the various things that can happen with elder abuse. So it kind of gave us an opportunity where we're looking to not only recruit for the things that RSVP did not PP does now, but also expand into this, these other programs that we think will really help deal with some of the problems that we're seeing out here. So there's lots of things that are happening, but again, the commitment to finish up the year is about $50,000. We'll take 1.5 staff, and then it'll double for the full year for 2016. That doesn't include tapping any other potential reimbursement streams that are out there. The RSVP grant, we would have to apply for that next year. I don't know that we will, to be honest with you. We're looking at it. There's a lot. It seems like you spent a lot of that time with the program reporting.
Yeah.
And so, again, I think that's one of the frustrations the college has been looking at it. Just for the $50,000 you draw down from the feds, you're spending a good portion of those dollars on documenting and reporting.
Right.
So it might be more strategic for the county to identify others. So we're looking at our office for the aging streams to see where there's opportunities to supplement, and also there might be some opportunity for some federal dollars through UCAP to help supplement this neighborhood program. So kind of this, what you're seeing before you today really is a stopgap, and then the full
right.
program, and you'll see that as part of the budget for 16.
Great.
About $100,000. I don't know how much of that will come from county sources versus other things we're going to be able to leverage. And there will be something. I'm not sure what it will be.
All right. Thanks, Ken. I entertain a motion to accept the resolution 205. Seconded by so all those in favor?
I don't hold from anybody to want as a co-sponsor. We listed Legislative Provenzano as a co-sponsor because he's on the board of RSVP. She had called and she really wanted to be part of that. So again, I would hope the whole committee was a co-sponsor.
Right. Well, normally when they're put in, it's done by herself and me.
Yeah, this was a special one just because Legislative Provenzano was on the board. I know she reached out to Legislative Morrow and Hoff, and they had both asked.
That's fine. That's fine. My ego's intact.
She is on the board of RSVP. I have one other thing that's new, too. You know, we've been working, those have been by the office and have been working on the memorial out front. And I wanted to pass around the pinnacle of the invitation that's going out for that. We expect it's going to be a pretty large dedication ceremony. I know we'll coordinate through the chairman and through the clerk of legislature. We have a complete understanding that they're coming and have appropriate seating for that. And we'll make those arrangements over the next couple of days. But I know that folks from all over the country are coming to display their colors and participate. And it should be nice that there are 1,306 names that are going to be on the board. It's very striking. When you actually see this, you notice they just finished the footprint of the memorial today. They put the landscaping around. You'll see them. They're going to sod the front lawn of the county house building over the next day or so. Tomorrow, you're going to see base stones that are set. I believe Monday they're scheduled to put the big tablets that go around the outside.
I gave you a name a while ago. Were you able to get?
I believe that was included.
Okay, yeah, because I know the person. Or it was her brother. He was never included on any of the other things, even though he,
I know that
during World War II, he was.
The committee that worked on it spent a lot of time. And to be honest with you, we expect that there's going to be additional names going forward. So what we've done is the committee was very thoughtful about it. And they arranged each conflict. And actually, this will be important for the committee to know. They actually used the actual official U.S. dates for the conflict. So if history may say World War I was longer than what we listed, they just listed the time that the United States was involved in they made that decision, and they randomized the names, and they left appropriate space for as many names to be added. They could do that.
That's a good idea.
Very good. Again, this, I think you'll be really struck by it when you see it. The power of all the names is a huge contribution from the residents of that county, but also the Civil War. Has over 630 names listed. And if you appreciate that, kind of the size of Ulster County back then, and kind of the role we played in the Union, to know what kind of impact that would have on families and a lot of our community, to have 635 people from that community die in that internal conflict. It's very powerful when you do it. It's striking. You see the revolutionary.
What's the total number that's out?
1,306 names is what's listed. And I believe 135 the Civil War alone. It's very powerful to see it. And again, you get Revolutionary War as a section, but then Civil War takes up several panels. It's very powerful to see it. And I'll see the final
point.
It's very powerful. So the bases will be tomorrow. They'll put the stones up on Monday. I think they're going to cover the stones until today. These dedications, I expect the families are again, it's very emotional. There's several close all-star families from the more recent couples that are going to participate in the ceremony. We've got to be respectful not to be able to name until the family can see the guys later. So those stuff will be covered in some day of the dedication. And there's a pentagon-shaped marble bench to go to the center. It'll be all set the night before the dedication and then the formal dedication
Very good. Thank you, Ken. Ready. We have family with Michael Berg is here. He's got a few things that he wants to talk about.
Thank you, Dan. Good evening. I'd like to introduce Serena Sanders. Serena does most of the supervised visitation program, and I thought there might be questions about its operation. I've given you a report on the supervised visitation program. I included statistics for 2014 and also the first 4 months of 2015. As you can see, the program is quite active. We did 331 visits in 2014, and 119 have been held already in 2015. Serena, why don't you describe how it works and what you do?
So we provide families each week an hour per week of visitation with their child, and it's really to fill the gap with between family court and the time that they settle their case. It gives them a chance to see their children at a time that they may not have been able to during that process. So it's really important, and it's really a gentle process to work with. So somebody sits, I sit in the room with the children and the parents and just observe their interaction, and then we send a report to family court and let them know our observations. We are a neutral party in the case. We don't get involved in the court case details. We're just there to give the court a different view, you know, of how the interaction is. Because a lot of times in the court cases, it comes, you know, certain things are said or it comes up and, you know, we kind of give some clarification of how the child reacts. Because it's really, you know, we're focusing on the child and,
quite often, one parent, the custodial parent, will claim that the non-custodial parent is inappropriate, is not going to be able to work with the child, and so that's one of the things that we report back to the court. The other thing is that occasionally a parent has been having the child's life for a long time, and so the court wants to make sure that the parent is going to relate to the child, that the child will feel comfortable with the parent. So we give quite a number of reports to report on cases.
Do you work with CASA at all on those type of things? Or?
No, not really. CASA has a role in the family court, but not in the supervised visitation. The one thing I would say, because it might be confusing, you see that a lot more sessions are requested than actually held. But that's not because we're not available. It's because the custodial parent decides that today is not a good day and I don't want them to see them. Or I don't want her to see it. And so they cancel, and we schedule it, but it doesn't happen.
So, excuse me, so when that happens, is the court notified?
Absolutely.
Every time, or is there a certain period of time before they're notified?
How it works is we send a report to them, to the court, approximately a week before the court case happens, and we document all the notes, plus any cancellations we cancel. And we let them know so that they know. So we don't do it on a regular basis, but it's always before the next
case. Before the court case.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can the parents request that information?
No, we provide that only to the judge in written report form, and then the judge disperses that to their attorneys to provide to the parents.
So do you provide any confirmation to the parents or to the lawyers that, you know, that it didn't get lost?
What we do is when we send the reports to the court, mm-hmm. we confirm with the secretary that the report was received.
Okay.
And then we also we assure parents during the visit, because sometimes they'll say, I want to make sure this is documented, and we assure them that everything that happens in the visit is documented, you know, for the judge to say.
Right. So really the lawyers don't know ahead of time?
Once they request the reports.
So the lawyers can request the reports?
Yep, from whoever the judge is that's treating the case.
Okay.
They can always request a report from them directly.
So is that before the court or after?
Before. Okay. That, so, for instance, if somebody was going to court this week, we would send a report in, and then within a few days before the court case, the attorneys can contact the judge.
Now, is there any safeguard or something from parents that repeatedly, you know, before, because sometimes court dates are 6 months, 8 months away. If a parent is repeatedly not showing up or canceling or whatever.
Typically, within three cancellations, we send it back to the court for them to review. Oftentimes, if it's the same parent that canceled all those times, we will send the case back for them to review before we go further with it.
Okay.
So we keep track of that. A lot of times, though, it is both parents, like, canceling one way or another.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't typically get involved in what the reasons are because everything can kind of seem justified, but it's just that it's an hour away,
right.
And, you know, parents
right.
to see their
right.
child.
Right. And I'm sure it does make a difference whether they did it the day before or 5 minutes before they're supposed to be there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Sure.
You should also know that this is not cases that involve Child Protective Services. In cases which involve Child Protective Services, CPS provides the supervision. But in all other cases coming before the family court, we do.
Now, do you ever recommend that, you know, I'm sure some cases sometimes come, you know, for supervised visitation. Do you also include anything, you know, I'm sure sometimes you see that you don't know why that would even be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we try to really remain neutral in the case and not get involved in the court case details so that we can see during the visits what's actually happened. Because then if we hear one thing or another, then,
right.
we don't want to be swayed in,
right.
you know, we want it to be factual and, you know.
So yours is based just on the observation during your, when you're there with the parent or the one parent, whoever is, whoever is being monitored.
The other thing is that we try and hold supervision, which is at the most convenient place for the parents. So we'll provide it in Ellenville, we'll provide it in New Paltz, we use our own resources to the greatest extent possible. But we feel that the visitation is really important. It's important for the child, and it's important for the court to be able to make good decisions about custody and visitation, to have a neutral observation of what.
How long does this visitation usually take?
They vary. It depends on how long the case is drawn out. Like, sometimes we do it for quite a few months.
But how long is during one, like, for instance, one visit?
Oh, for one visit, it's 1 hour per week.
I want to say that we're able to provide so many visits because the legislature gave us an additional $5,000. If you look at it, we're doing a lot for the $20,000 that you give us, and it's because of the way that we structured the program. We're only paying Serena for the hours that she's providing the visits, and we have other consultants that will provide it in Ellenville or where it needs to be. We feel that this program is really important, and so we've tried to keep the cost down as much as possible.
Oh, it's definitely is important.
No, are siblings included? Or it depends on the court order?
The court, usually the court doesn't order siblings in to start because they want to see how the parent and that child is. But what I tell them, because a lot of parents, you know, and children in the business want their siblings. So what I tell them is if they speak to their attorney and put in a petition to the judge, a lot of times the judge will approve it, but they may have to go back to court because sometimes if a child has a different parent on one end,
right.
they have to go back to court for approval, but we are fine with that. At one time, we actually allowed children in, but the court specifically asked that we get approval from them first because it can get...
Okay, so you do it if it's a court approval.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's important to keep them in contact and... having some contact while they
because I think the siblings are forgotten a lot of times.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So they don't understand why they can't see. You know, so it's, yeah.
And it's very important to the child that they not lose contact with their brothers and sisters.
Right. Because I know even with CPS cases, like a child could be in Ulster County and their sibling could be up in Buffalo and they're required so many visitations with them. Whether it comes to transpire or not, they bring them up there and sometimes, you know, circumstances don't wind up allowing it to happen, but they do have they do try to keep that bond up.
Yeah, it's very
important. And it is important, yeah.
How controlled is the environment?
The environment, well, right now we do them over at Darmstadt Shelter. We have a nice living room set up. So even when it's like Christmas time, there's a nice tree that everybody opens their presents and stuff. So we have, the building actually has camera monitoring, and it's locked at the front door. So each parent comes 15 minutes apart, and I bring the visiting parent in first, and then 15 minutes later, the custodial parent comes with the child, and then, you know, so we have access to the door to meet them and stuff, just so that, and the other staff is nice because the environment is controlled, because all the other staff is trained to understand, like, you know, our process, so it makes it very peaceful for everybody.
It depends on the type of case that they have. That's a basically factor in how much control you have over it, how much interaction you allow between everyone, and then something's not ready.
Yeah, the custodian visiting parent never have contact on the premises right now, because that's at the point when we get the case, that's what the court is asking for us to do. And then from, you know, the next step after us is usually probably where they start implementing maybe family counseling or, you know, whatever the court deems necessary.
But we are available also, Serena and other people doing it, to answer questions for the parent about parenting issues or age appropriate, and that's really important too.
Any further questions on this? All right. We have another program that I...
180
program. Now, this program is now not funded.
It's funded until the end of the year.
Until December.
This program, we responded to a request for proposal from the Department of Criminal Justice Services. And when we saw the proposal, we were somewhat surprised at it. It was targeting 7 to 15-year-olds that have committed a crime which, if they were 18, would have gone to jail. The intent of the program was to provide restorative justice and to get the young person to recognize that they had hurt somebody else and that they had hurt society by their actions. So we've trained about 25 leaders in the community to form what are called juvenile accountability boards. And three or four of the members of that group will meet with the young person, will have the young person describe what they did in detail and question them, and then discuss with them and ask them to acknowledge and recognize that they had damaged another person, that they had hurt their community by their actions. And then they discuss what an appropriate response is to rectify that. They write a letter to the person that they've hurt, or they do an action to respond to that, and they're also given a responsibility to respond to the community. They do community service. So in 2014, we served 56 youth completed the program. Another 8 of them are currently in the program. And of the 56, only one reoffended, which we think is phenomenal. I can't but say, I mean, we're so proud of that. And so then to hear that in December the program is going to end and the state is no longer going to fund it, you know, when you have a real success story, that's really hard to accept. So now we're scurrying around to try and figure out, we do not want this program to close. We think it's really working. And most importantly, we're having access to children at a time when you actually can make a difference. The saddest part of this program is the recognition that what these kids need is a little attention, a little understanding, somebody that cares about them, somebody who will spend quality time with them. So our caseworker, who's helping them through this process, becomes almost the parent-like to them, and it's really made a huge difference in these young people's lives. We had some kids that the Juvenile Accountability Board suggested that they work with horses, and there was a farm near them, and so they went in their woods, mopping the stalls, and after their community service was done, they continued to do it because it was a wonderful thing. They really liked it. And so that's the kind of things that we're trying to find. And the program has been really successful, and we're very proud of it. We have people that are providing the service all around the county at about 3 walk-in centers outside of Kingston. And so it's been a good program, and we're going to figure out how to continue it.
Are the caseworkers
part of your staff?
Yes, they're part of our staff, absolutely.
So they're not dedicated just to this?
No. Well, the way that we work is this. We have two programs. One is called the 180 program, which targets 7 to 15-year-olds. The other one is called the SBSJP, which I wish I could remember. But it's targeted to 16 and older kids who have gotten into more trouble.
Yeah.
So instead of having one worker that does the county for one program, we're half of their time is devoted to each program. So we have three workers, one in New Pulse, one in Ellenville, and one outside of our Kingston office. So we can deliver this service countywide.
With the older kids, is that going to disappear too at this point?
No, that's ongoing. That's ongoing. So the program, we estimate that at a minimum, we could run the program for somewhere between $100,000 and $105,000. That's how much it costs to have the three workers at a time. And we're going to try and raise it. We'll look to foundations. We think that the results of the program are so significant that somebody will want to look at that and say, this should be continued. I don't know what else to do.
That was shut down because?
Because it was a pilot program with every state program. How are you going to sustain this program? And if I were writing the truth, I would say, are you kidding? How am I going to find $115,000 in this environment? The counties are losing money. But you can't, if you say that, you'll get the money. So we said we would see foundation.
So the pilot program has succeeded and then
it stopped. I'm sure it's not the way you would do business. I would say that if the program proves itself, the state, I could see the state cutting its money in half.
Someday,
go get the rest of the money. This is such a good program. But that's not the way it's structured. You do a good job. It takes you time to build the relationships to get the referrals. Now we're really getting a lot of referrals.
The other programs for 16 to 19, is that what it is?
16 to 20.
20? The problem is with that.
That is going to keep going.
Yes, as far as we know. That's a program that primarily funds the MST program Penny's program, the community. It's a program that has collaborative staff for probation, mental health, and DSS. It's run out of the DSS. And the state allocates money to that. We provide a portion of that, providing case management in the case that they have identified. And so that program seems to be ongoing. Initially, they said, oh, this is a one-year program with that, but it turned out not to be. But we called the state twice. Are you sure that you're not going to fund? You can't fund the portion?
Now, the problem is with the, 16 to 20, it's a lot harder to turn them around.
Yeah. Well, so that's why we want to reach them at 5 to 7 to 15.
Yeah, I mean, you have a much better success story with the 7 to 15.
I think you have success with the 16
but
to
20. Unfortunately, it's sort of like, the horses are already out of the barn, sort of now. It's hard to get them back in. When these 7 to 15-year-olds are much more impressionable.
Well, I think it's mostly boredom and the lack of supervision that gets a kid into trouble. We had one kid that threw a rock at his neighbor's window. He was just bored.
And who's with him?
His neighbor's with him. So I would have to answer questions.
We needed this program when John was younger. We would shoot one of those rocks.
It always surprises me how these monies dry up for these type of programs. Even if you can help a couple of people, like in the long run, the alternative for the cars
right
cheaper.
Think about if even 25% of the kids that we served ended up in the county jail, and what would be the ongoing damage? I mean, these kids are back in school, their attendance is better, we're getting reports from the schools on their grades, so we're really following up to make sure that they're doing well and to be able to demonstrate the effectiveness of the program. I will share with you that we presented before the Human Rights Commission because
the probation officer, Trish Cena, who's been really, really wonderful and supportive of the program, approached the Human Rights Commission and wanted us to present to it, because this is the program that she is most proud of in her career, because she sees so many results. And that felt wonderful. So family has a commitment that we don't start programming casually, and we certainly don't end it casually. It's not easy to make up that kind of money, but we will try. So I would answer any questions about it if you have any. Thank you for
that. Thank you, Michael. We'll be looking into this and seeing what we can do.
Thank you for any help.
Without a doubt. I mean, I'd like to see something, you know, maybe if we can give you some of the money and you can...
That would certainly help. And, you know, to be able to go to a foundation and say the county has stepped up and...
Right. Oh, yeah. That's
a huge difference.
Right.
So that would be very significant.
May I ask, the communities where the youngsters are from,
they're all right with that.
Is it not just...
No, not at all. No. We have three workers around the county that are all providing this service, and we train people all around the county to do the children's home.
So it's probably spread almost around every town. Or...
Sure. Well, we did 56 kids, so it's a lot.
Mm-hmm. You have a number of them in Roundout, right?
Right.
Yes, we have some in Roundout. We do certainly have some in Kingston. But the outlying communities have been referring to us quite a bit. Once the police saw that there was something that was going to happen and that they could not have to prosecute, not have to be the heavy in it, they liked the program. We were getting referrals from the schools. We've been getting referrals from the police. And this one other major referral, which always changes my mind. But, yes, the program is now taking hold. And, you know, it takes a long time to turn the faucet on. And for people to know, oh, yeah, about that, I can refer to that program. So now to stop that would be almost the same.
Now, ready? All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
You
all.
The real frustration with the grants of contact, especially state and federal, and we're seeing that in cooperative extension as well, is they start these programs, they're successful, which is what
you
they wanted. And you're able to really work with what you've got and whatever, and then they're just cut off, or they're cut off halfway through, or and it's just so frustrating.
But you would understand if it was unsuccessful, but
right.
You ain't a successful program.
Well, if they would say, all right, we're going to give you half of the money to continue the program if you could find the other half, only for those programs that were really successful,
right.
They'd be spending a quarter of their money and be able to retain a lot of programming.
Mark, so curiously, was this done in other counties?
The program was offered by DCJS in the entire state,
and
anyone could write for it.
Or a non.
So yes, yes, and we were given. It was interesting. The application gave us choices as to what intervention we would do, and so we chose the Juvenile Accountability Board because we thought having a young person go before a board of leaders in the community and having the leaders of the community relate to that young person would be powerful. We didn't know if it would work, but it was the model we chose. And we were able to find about 25 people that were willing to be trained in it. We were fortunate that the Albany Probation Department was willing to give us training for free. And a whole group from the county went up there and were trained in the model. And it's really worked. It's been a wonderful model. I don't want to give it up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All righty. And so, last but not least.
Well, welcome to Cornell Cooperative Extension of Ulster County. Happy to have you here and in our spiffy meeting room, whatever, which we're really pretty proud of because this is the biggest meeting room we've had in our 100-year history. And it certainly has been well used. We have a lot of, sometimes even other not-for-profits and whatever requesting to use it and whatever, because I guess good meeting space in the county is difficult to find. But we're able to put 80 people in here without tables, just with chairs. With tables and whatever, probably about 40. And so it's actually worked out really very well for us. The heating and cooling system is not exactly designed really well for this building since this used to be Blockbuster. And before it was Blockbuster, I think it was Walgreens? Walgreens built the whatever. So that's why it's so loud and so cold. The air conditioning is not working in the rest of the building, which is why it was so warm when we came in. But that's kind of part of the course, I think, with the summer coming as quickly as it did. Although tomorrow is supposed to be spring again. So, and I guess we missed the snow that just hit Colorado. So that's all good. So this is our main office here in Kingston. We also have two outlying offices. We have one in Highland. We've been involved with that. It's actually the Ag Experiment Station, which is the building and land is owned by a cooperative of fruit growers. And it is rented by Cornell University, and they run an experiment lab out of that. And we have had offices there, I don't know, 50 years, I guess. And so the staff that we have that work directly with the fruit industry and sometimes the vegetable industries are housed down there. And now grapes and other commodities that we find are more centered in the southern part of the county. So we have about five staff. Three that are there full-time, two that are there part-time, and they go back and forth between the Kingston office and there. We also have another office in Chopin, just recently moved to Chopin. Before that, it was in up the road. in Benicia, thank you. I come up with a piece. And that is an office that's been in that area for probably about 7 years, and it houses our environmental program that we work with New York City DEP. They actually fund it and have funded it for 7 years. Our role in that is education and working with community leaders, residents, county departments, state agencies, et cetera, enhancing the quality of water and the residents' lives. And it's really, it was one of those things that I looked at in the beginning and thought, geez, I don't know, that's kind of could be a real sticky wicket because it had relationships that had been up there between DEP and the city, and the residents, long-term residents, had not been a real positive one. But I think they were looking for facilitation, and that's something that we do, so I think it's actually worked out really well, and I think some of the materials that have been produced on not so much just the geological part of keeping water clean, but in getting communities involved in understanding and protecting their own water and their own waterways and whatever, have been a model across the country. So really good program that we're working with, and probably the biggest grant and contract that Cooperative Extension has. The next one after that is with the New World Foundation, Local Economies Program, which enhanced the agricultural education that we were able to do out of this office. Before we got involved with that, even with all the agriculture that we have here in Ulster County, because of budgets and whatever, we actually only had two ag professional staff. One was housed down in Highland, one was housed here. Working with fruits and vegetables, and the fruit position was shared with five other counties. So local economies folks came to us and said they had a vision for a farm hub and a food hub and enhancing local products and an education program that would help consumers understand how important it was to support agriculture where it was. Noting the fact that we are within 90 miles of a huge market, that we didn't have all of our farmers taking full advantage of. We had some, but not a whole lot. So we got involved with that about 4 years ago, and we went from two professional ag staff to eight. We have the largest ag staff of any association, Cooperative Extension Association in the state. Those folks work regionally as well as right here in Ulster County, and it's been, I think, really successful. They're doing all kinds of applied research, deeply involved with Cornell faculty from other land-grant universities, Penn State, Rutgers, et cetera, do a lot of work in hops, a lot of work in small grains, because distilleries have become a hot topic in New York State, and we've got quite a few here in Ulster County as well. Craft beers are also very well regarded, and we've always had some wineries here, but I think from the work that's going on now, those wineries are really benefiting by the kind of expertise that we can bring in, knowing about varieties and those kinds of things. This was a particularly difficult year for grape growers with the winter that we had. The one good thing was is that we had so much snow, and so that saved the vines from the snow level on down. The ones that were above the snow got hit pretty hard. But I know that they're working on that. Right now, Fruit Educator is dealing with a fire blight. For those of you know about apples and whatever, that's like the worst thing that you want on your property. And it happens at bloom when you have high humidity and not much rain. And so the conditions are really ripe for fire blight to go through. And I don't remember if it's fungus or virus or whatever. I should have had my tag here. But if you get it within a stand of trees, you have to pull the trees out. That's how bad it is. And destroy the trees. So that's what they're working on at this particular point. The winter was not detrimental to fruit trees, at least apples. Some of the peaches and the apricots and whatever got hit because it was just so cold for so long. But the worst, the crop that got hit the worst was probably the grape crop. So we work with all of that. Our role in the areas that we work in the environment, in agriculture, in healthy communities, and in forage development is education. That's what our mission is. And extending the research that's done at land-grant universities and other universities back to the people who helped foot the bill. That was the basic premise of cooperative extension when it first started back in 1915. It was the basis of the land-grant university system that was started back in 1864 and continues this today as well. We have a healthy communities program. We do a lot of work with low-income nutrition programs. All of those are grant and contract funded. We also have a pretty robust program for relatives as parents, for people who find themselves raising children that they're related to but aren't their original parents for various reasons. The numbers are much higher, I think, than people realize, and it's also an unseen problem because a lot of folks who find themselves in these situations don't go for assistance that they could or they should get to help them with this. Because oftentimes these families are in distress, whether when it comes with money or the stress of older folks trying to take care of young folks and all the hassles that brings, because they don't want it known that they're doing it because they're afraid they're going to lose those kids. You know, so anyway, we do work with the program with that. Again, our role is education and support. So we have support groups. We have some kids here tonight that are involved in one of our forage development programs. They're learning how to sew basically here. Try to find activities for them that make them feel like they're a part of the community and that they're not different. Another big program that we've done.
I wanted to ask, if you bring up the idea that there's a lot more going on with distilleries and things of that nature today, and it's, you know, it's taking off a lot of places throughout the country, really. I mean, and I'm wondering, maybe Mark might know something in reference to the college looking at some of those type of courses at some point. I don't know if you've looked into that, or in other words,
working with Cornell to try and bring together a program.
Oh, okay.
The
because they have a, you know, sometimes what happens is these people want to know how to do the distillery, and, you know, distill and so on and so forth. They know the process, but they often don't really understand the operations and the business end of it. And, you know, sometimes something like that, some type of a program or a, you know, a course of a, you know, a set of courses that they could put together. Maybe they can get some type of distilling certificate or whatever they may call it. But the idea of actually them creating that type of business.
We work with that.
Because you've got successful people around the area, but it's...
Cornell has a whole program in it as well, the university, but we do a lot of introductory kinds of things for folks that are thinking about doing that kind of thing, what would be involved, whatever. That's kind of the thought behind the whole Farm Hub.
Right.
Well,
see, what I thought about, like, if you work with the college and stuff like that, and they actually create credit-bearing courses, that could be credit-bearing courses in business. Right. Because the, Right. But, I mean, because I've seen this in other, I think it was I'm trying to remember where the college I saw, it was a community college that actually offered it. And they did the business end of distilleries, and in other words, so they got involved in that type of thing where, in other words, they got, business credits, and they got, they'd take accounting, they would do certain things, in other words, to get through it. But they also zeroed in on actually making the product at the same time, creating it. In other words, because there's a call for that type of stuff. It really is. I mean, there's a science of it is part of it.
Start a
culinary program or something like that with a large investment upfront. Right.
Yeah, you got a lot of
good outcome.
It's a high cost
program.
Right.
So that's one of the reasons
you have to jump on this.
Maybe get somebody else to do the other end. You do the business part.
Well, we're in conversations with the community college. Always have been. But we've been looking for opportunities to do some more of the ag type of things. And especially since the university, the community college has got such a strong vet science program, that we work with them in providing some opportunities for youngsters. But we're looking at providing coursework classes or whatever, whether they be credit bearing or not, for folks that are interested in working with livestock, but don't really want to be a vet tech. So for the owner. An owner looking for somebody that had those kinds of classes or certificate or whatever would certainly be something to write up. So we're looking to build on what we've got that we're already strong in, because starting new stuff is daunting sometimes, unless you've got a limited pocketbook. And I don't know, we haven't had that forever, so I don't think most people do. And then we have our 4-H youth development program that I know a lot of you are aware of and know of. We have two women who are working with that program who have done yeoman's work with it with the least amount of funding that we've ever had for the 4-H youth development program. And they've got the numbers of kids that are involved and the clubs that are involved at the highest levels that they have been in 50 years. I don't know how they did it. I don't know how they sustain it. Because it's a tremendous amount of work to provide support for those kinds of volunteer groups. And again, our role is in training the adults who work with the kids, so for the kind of opportunities that the kids are looking for. So that's been a real success story for us. And if you get to the Ulster County Fair, you'll see the fruits of those labors. The kids put all their stuff up on display. This building, we've been here now for about 3 years. This move was a really good one for us as far as the community recognizing who we are and where we are. We've been in other places. We were at 74 John Street, which is the Pearson House, from 1913 until 1999. In 99, we moved to 10 Westbrook Lane. And even though millions of folks went by that, nobody knew that we were there. We had a sign out and whatever, but folks didn't see it. Coming here to the plaza with the great big Cornell Cooperative Extension sign and the pictures in the front, we have people that are stopping all the time, coming in, asking about Cornell, asking about work that we do. So this has been really an excellent move. And although it was a little trying to get here, to get to this point and whatever, it's been extremely beneficial for us to be here. So. Our programs are subscribed, sometimes oversubscribed. This evening we have 12 people in the kitchen learning about pressure canning. Who would guess? Pressure canning and cooking classes and whatever were things that Cooperative Extension did and were known from since it started. Food safety, the original Cooperative Extension home economist would go out to the outlying areas by train sometimes. They would have sent a letter to have women say, how the fire's going and we need so many jars and whatever, and they would go out and talk about how to safely can. that was what our heritage was. I'd say in the 70s and 80s, the interest was not there so much from the general population, nor was the money to support those programs, so we stopped doing them. And we got into the low-income nutrition kinds of things because there were dollars to help support that. And we found ourselves in the past, I'd say 7 or 8 years, back to the basics of what people feel are important in their lives. They want to be able to grow their own food. They want to preserve it. They want to know what they're eating. They're not looking for additives and stuff. And we can do that. So we run those programs on a cost basis. They're not that expensive. They're probably open to anyone. If somebody really wants to take the course and can't afford it, we make accommodations for that as well. Finding that we have more and more people signing up for that.
How much is the canning course?
Geez, I don't know. I could go ask Jeannie and find out. We also have been running some programs called ServSafe, which is a certification program for, we've done this in conjunction with the college as well. And I have to say that working with the college and the college reach is much bigger than ours. And so we've had a lot more people taking place with that. But if you're a food worker, they're looking for those certifications. And it's at least a 10-hour course, I think, that people have to do, and then they're tested on the end. And if you're in the food service industry, you're required to have those kinds of things. So we run the courses. We run them here. We've had a lot of people do that as well.
Could I be curious? I might sign up.
$30 to take home the food you can.
No, very good.
You know, if a class fills up fast, do you offer another one?
Yes. Good. Yes. Matter of fact, that class was supposed to be in here tonight, and I kind of bumped them out. And we were thinking that out of the 12, you know, maybe half didn't come, they're all in.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you have any questions about what we do or how we do it or whatever. I would invite you to come and spend some time with us. If there's anything in particular you're interested in, the hops or the small grains or whatever. We are funded mostly with grants and contracts at this point. Our budget is about $2.5 million. That doesn't include the monies that we have to hand out in grants through the New York City DEP program and a couple of other programs that we run as well, where we're given money and we manage a grants program for the local community. So we've been pretty busy lately and hope to stay that way and whatever. And again, our basis is education, and I like to say it's on the practical end of what folks need to know in order to have a successful life here in Ulster County.
Well, thank you, Lee, and you are our economic development engine, one of them in the county. So the money that we give you, you leverage a great deal of money for that, and also have a number of employees. And so if you want to compare it with the IDA, you beat them every time. Thank you. Any questions for Lee? Or
no? I can just hear it now. If you have a distillery program with your college,
you signed up?
Kids telling their parents, I'm going to go to school.
I may go back. I mean, I don't know. I might have to go back to school. Get my a doctorate in mixology or something.
There you go.
Well, in the 70s, it was a lot of people did wine at home.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
Now, you know.
Well, Kieran, actually, the spirits also.
All those craft beers are popular. The IPA is the real hoppy stuff.
Yes. Yeah. During the time of the Revolution, hops was the biggest thing that we grew here.
Yeah.
So things change, and then they come back. But we have a couple of, we have quite a few plots out for the small grains and hops and whatever. Justin, one of our ag educators, has gotten, I think, 5 or 6 different grants from different sources to do applied research in those areas. And we have growers that are very interested in helping to sponsor that. They get to see what's growing, what grows really well, what works on different kinds of things as far as additives and those kinds of things and whatever. So we've always had a really, really great relationship with growers. And I think they see cooperative extension as really valuable to their businesses as and helping them stay profitable.
All righty, thank you. Any other, any other old business, new business, or anything anybody want to bring up? Otherwise, I'd entertain a motion to adjourn. All those in favor? Aye. Aye. Right on. Thank you.